Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Tudors Dynasty Podcast. And now, Rebecca Larson.
Welcome to the show. This episode is my final episode before I take a brief break from recording. Don't worry, I'll be back in September. When I made the announcement that I would be switching to seasons in order to be able to spend more time with my family, I figured I needed my final episode to be a big one, one to hold you over for 2 months. I'm pleased to announce that, in my opinion, I was able to do just that by booking Dan Jones as a guest. Dan Jones is a historian and author who many of you may recognize without needing an introduction. For those who are not as familiar with Dan, you may recognize him as the host of Secrets of Great British Castles on Netflix or narrator of Britain's Bloodiest Dynasty, as well as a plethora of Tudor-themed programs. Dan has 8 books under his belt, with his most recent one, Crusaders, due out in the fall in the U.S. It is with great pleasure that I welcome Dan Jones to the show today. Dan, welcome to the show.
It is very nice to be on the show. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I would like to start out with a couple questions to kind of get to know you, and then we'll kind of circle back again and just kind of have it all tie in together. So are you ready?
Born ready. You ask me anything you want, and I'll endeavor to tell you the truth.
Oh, that could be dangerous. Well, first we'll start. As you probably know, I am a huge fan of your Facebook Live videos that you do on occasion.
And God, yeah.
I love them. You just come off as very real when you do them. So I think that's why a lot of your followers appreciate them so much. In your videos, you mention your daughters. Now, I'm curious, are they interested in history at all?
The short answer is no. They more or less couldn't care less about the entire sum of human deeds and achievements. And that's a reaction against me personally. And I feel like a little bit of guilt about that, because it's quite a big thing to carry, to put two people off the whole corpus of human history. But I seem to have managed it. But look, they're young, you know, and you don't need that many children. I mean, both my kids they're under the age of 11. So you can't expect them to be that interested in history at this age. And maybe they'll come around to it. I mean, I wasn't like a history nerd until I was like 30. No, not 30, but like, you know, like 18 maybe. So I don't have massively high expectations of them in their childhood.
I can completely relate to that. My teenage son, he's 15. He thinks I'm a nerd because of my obsession with history. His life is surrounded.
He thinks you're a nerd because of your obsession with history, or he thinks you're a nerd and you're obsessed with history?
Okay, maybe the latter. But his life is surrounded by, you know, online video games, Dungeons and Dragons. So my question for you is, what would you say to him to get him interested in learning about, say, the Plantagenets or the Tudors?
Well, listen, I think that's kind of a hard sell. That's like, let's imagine we were drug dealers and we were formulating a strategy for getting people hooked on our most profitable drug, which might be, let's say, heroin or crack cocaine. I wouldn't go out into the street and say, hey, guys, smoke the crack pipe. I would like give them gateway drugs and like, oh, you know, take a little shot of tequila and then, hey, smoke a little weed, you know. And I think that slightly immoral analogy applies to history also. I think you can't just like force people into liking your own particular area of kind of nerdery straight off the bat. So I think that the way to draw people, and it doesn't have to be younger people, but it can just be people who don't naturally feel a sort of affinity for history. The way to draw them in is very often historical fiction, One of the reasons that, gosh, and we're going to mention this earlier in the interview than I suppose I'd even imagined, that Game of Thrones has been so successful is that it's, you know, from a historical point of view, is that it's drawn people into the kind of broader morass, the broader world of historical settings, the medieval setting, in a way that feels kind of exciting and in somehow or other relatable or fantastic or sexy or cool or whatever. So, I mean, I think the best way to draw people into history in general is to give them great stories that they're going to enjoy as stories per se, and not to try and drive them straight to the kind of, you know, the hard stuff, the stuff that you and I are on, right? I think it's about gently introducing Jay-Z. You know, of course, you know who Jay-Z is. Jay-Z is a very famous rapper. Jay-Z used to say about trying to smuggle a conscious message into his music. He was like, you know, you've got to feed them sugar. You've got to feed people like the stuff that they like, and then drip, drip, bit by bit, the more serious messaging in. And I've always thought that that's quite a nice analogy.
So you mentioned historical fiction, and that was great because that was exactly where I was going with my questioning here. You mentioned Game of Thrones, which, of course, we all know is a huge success with the books and the series. What do you like to read other than Game of Thrones when you're not researching and writing?
So when I'm working, which is, let's say, 40 or 45, yeah, maybe 42, 45 weeks of the year when I'm writing, I pretty much just read what's pertaining to the book I'm writing. So if I'm writing about the Templars, I'm just reading mainly nonfiction and academic stuff pertaining to the subject, right? Then I go on vacation, however many, you know, weeks of the year, and take the family away. And then I just read fiction. And so, and I go through phases. So I went through a long phase, which I'm sort of on the back of at the moment, of reading like hard-boiled American detective kind of crime fiction. So think like everything from, you know, the old classics like Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, through to the sort of modern masters like James Ellroy, George Pelicanos, Denny Lehane, who else? Richard Price, those kind of writers. So I had a big, big kind of mood for those writers. What else have I got? I then, the last vacation we went on, I read quite a lot of kind of 1970s women writers, like particularly a great friend of mine gave me some Eve Babbitt's stories, like written about 1970s LA. So I've quite like an eclectic taste in fiction, which veers toward Americana. And that may not sound like it connects particularly with medieval history. And that, I guess that's part of the point. Like I try and just go way, way out of the world that I've spent most of the year in and just read stuff that I'm really going to enjoy, that, you know, I can't put down. And I sort of take everywhere and take in the swimming pool, and it ends up all kind of dog-eared and the pages falling out and sun bleached. And so that's kind of my happy space for reading, I guess.
So one of the things that's been a hot topic on social media lately is historians who have crossed over to writing fiction. Now, if you were to write fiction, or maybe even say historical fiction, what would you want to write about?
That's a good question. And it's, you know, it's a question that from time to time I consider. And I've had a couple of editors over the years have tried to sort of push me into, not push me into sort of with a gun on my back, but steer me towards the idea of writing historical fiction. And it's something I've, like, definitely not written off, but been wary of doing half-cocked, if that makes sense, like half-heartedly.
Completely.
So to address your question directly, what would I write? Well, you know, I would probably take a very obvious commercial decision and say, I'm not going to go off and write about radical feminism in, or, you know, early feminism in 1970s LA, right? I mean, much as I probably would like to. That wouldn't make sense commercially, and nobody would take me seriously or buy my book. So it would obviously be a kind of, I imagine, a medieval setting, drawing themes and or characters out of work I've done. You know, I came out of writing about the late 14th century, and that's kind of always where my heart lies, and there are some great stories. I think in my sense is, and I speak as a great novice here, no, not even a great novice, just a novice, that what is fruitful for historical period fiction, the backdrop of a time of great change. And in that sense, I would look at the 14th century probably because you have these sort of great moments of, you know, a plague that destroys circa 50% of Europe's population, and a period of the birth of the nation state and great popular rebellions, and things that would probably speak to an audience today on more than one level. So what's my short answer? I guess I'd write historical fiction set in the late 14th century.
Wonderful. So turning maybe more specifically to your work again, you span an impressive period of time with your books, several centuries, actually. What would you like listeners to take away specifically from your research into the Crusaders?
So my book, Crusaders, and that's the one for this autumn, is going back to a span of history probably that I haven't, you know, a span that's at least as big as Plantagenet's, which is my second book. And it's like 400 years. It ranges from, you know, geographically from obviously the Holy Land, but as far east as Mongolia and Iran, all the way west, you know, to Britain and France and Ireland. And even the end of the book, this sort of great moment of discovery of the New World. So in a sense, the Americas. So it is what I hope people take away from it. And they may... If people have any preconception of what the Crusades were all about, then it tends to be this sort of Richard the Lionheart versus Saladin kind of little period at the end of the 12th century, in which you just had basically a bunch of white French men with beards getting at a bunch of kind of Kurds and Syrians and Egyptians, also with beards and also men. And what I've tried to do with Crusaders is absolutely blow out the scope. So not just geographically, but also the caste list. So I tell this story through the viewpoints of this incredibly diverse range of characters. And I'm trying to be almost provocative in casting those characters. So we have the story of the Third Crusade told through the eyes or framed through the adventures of a woman from Yorkshire in northern England called Margaret of Beverley, who fights Saladin on the walls of Jerusalem wearing a cooking pot on her head instead of a helmet, you know. And we tell this, you know, the story of the origins of the Crusades through the eyes of a wandering Sicilian Arab Muslim poet called Ibn Hamdis, who wanders the courts of southern Europe composing poetry for the Muslim rulers of that area to kind of set the scene of what Europe was like at that time. So I think what I want readers to come away with from Crusaders is a sense of like, wow, what a like dazzlingly disparate and diverse and intriguing world this was, far bigger and more exotic than the usual vision we have of the Crusade story. And with far more interwoven adventures in strange and wonderful places than we ever really realize.
Prior to your book, Crusaders, you wrote one on the Templars, correct?
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that the Templars influenced or otherwise impacted the success of the Crusades?
Well, it's hard to talk about Templar success, really, because the story of the Templars is really one of, it's a tragedy, right? You know, if we frame it in dramatic terms, and obviously that's taking slightly a leap from history through to drama, but you see what I'm saying. And the story of the Templars is about valiant failure, and in the end, betrayal and annihilation. What you sort of see in the Templars with regards to the broader crusading world, I think, is this. They are the manifestation of two ideas and types within the medieval world, medieval Western Christian world, fused together. That of the man of religion, or in some cases the woman of religion, because there were female affiliates to the temple, with the warrior. So the warrior and the religious person combine in one being. And in a sense, that's what the Crusades, certainly at their outset in the very late 11th century, are all about. It's about saying, hey, you know what? It's possible to express your piety as a Latin Christian, that is, someone who professes obedience ultimately to the Pope in Rome. It's possible to express your faith through going thousands of miles away from home and killing other human beings. And that's something that Jesus would have tipped his cap if he were wearing one and said, good show, lads, well done. You know, and that's quite an improbable extrapolation of the teachings of Christ. I think you'd agree to say that, hey, you know what, the thing that guy was really after was for us to all start killing each other. You know, when you think about it, that's pretty much the absolute opposite of the message of Christ's ministry. But the theological and political gymnastics that the men mainly who conceived of the Crusades and the crusading movement were such that it was all about going killing in the name of Christ. And the Templars, who sprung out directly of the crusading movement in the aftermath of the First Crusade, were a sort of institutionalized sort of radical fundamentalist elite unit of crusaders. And so they crystallized the message, if you like.
The Templars really seem to be everywhere in pop culture right now, you know, from books to movies like National Treasure and TV shows like Curse of Oak Island, which you and I have talked about. Why do you think that is?
Why are the Templars everywhere in pop culture? Partly because they seem superficially to be very sort of mysterious, scandalous, austere, sexy, and misunderstood. And there is a tantalizing amount of evidence about the Templars, but an even more tantalizing absence of evidence about the Templars, partly as the result of the destruction of the Central Templar archive, which leaves this great sort of space in which you can invent all sorts of weird and wonderful things about them, and it's quite hard to categorically refute the wildest and most lurid speculation about the Templars, because there is this absence of evidence. Partly it's the result of just a shroud of myth and legend that has grown up around the Templars since the time of Eschenbach writing in 1200, putting the Templar-like knights into the stories of King Arthur. This has been going on for hundreds of years. People have looked at the Templars and thought, wow, that's a weird and strange group of people. Let's make some myths about them. The Da Vinci Code obviously played a massive part in this, you know, the rolling together of the Templars. But I think also the suspicion prevalent in the modern world that there are powerful, invisible groups of people, mostly men, who control the world through their networks, through their wealth, through their political connections, through their geographical mobility and range. The broad-based, in the US and Europe anyway, suspicion of quote-unquote elites at the moment speaks exactly to the sort of things that people suspected about the Templars. Hey, hang on a second, these are people who tapped into religion and politics and finance and warfare, and they're super rich and they've got a bunch of nice stuff and they wear uniforms and they only fraternize with one another. It's the same, you know, we do have this sense that the world is influenced by such networks of people. And when you see one, like the Templars in history, that it's possible to find out about and to sort of gawp at, if you like, and, you know, and particularly because of the scandalous nature of the Templars' downfall in the early 14th century, it's only natural to start like hyping them up. And I'm not complaining, because it's been very good for business. You know, writing about the Templars was one of the most fascinating historical journeys I ever went on, and it really tapped a nerve, and I'm glad I did it.
So now I want you to tell everybody whether or not you believe that they really buried a treasure 200 feet underground on Oak Island.
Jesus Christ. No, of course not. That's mental.
I just had to get you.
The day they find anything on Oak Island, that show will be cancelled because it will no longer have a purpose. It's entirely quixotic, and its whole drive is the sort of quest for the end of the rainbow. It's great television. It is great television. It's a sophisticated TV show. Unfortunately, it peddles horse shit.
It's funny because my husband and I watch it religiously, knowing that there's no treasure. We know it. But yet every week they find a little something that pulls you back in and makes you wonder, like, oh, here's a little piece of leather from a book binding. Could it be part of Shakespeare's lost manuscript? Could it? You know, and it gets us.
Like you've said the exact phrase on which the whole premise of Oak Island works, which is, could it be? And of course, the answer is no. But it's very hard. That's something that's very hard to prove. If I say, could it rain slugs tomorrow and blood pour from my eyes? Like you would go, no. I'd go, go on, then prove it. And you'd be unable to because tomorrow hasn't happened yet. You'd only be able to prove it when tomorrow came. And it didn't rain slugs and no blood poured from my eyes. But by then it would be too late.
I love your reaction. It's fantastic. So I had recently watched the interview that you did with our friend Christine Morgan after your release.
Christine. Yeah. 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 What did I say?
Well, you admitted it's nothing bad. You admitted that you're a fan of Eleanor of Aquitaine. So I'm curious, what is it about her that intrigues you so?
It's just the most improbable story, isn't it? And this, you know, quite often what you see in medieval history is people trying to hype up the deeds of women to try valiantly and correctly, I think, in many senses, to show that this wasn't just the most terrible misogynistic world, which kept women in a inferior position and denied them power, status, rights, and respect. And very often that effort is a failure because you're fighting against the facts about the medieval world. However, in Eleanor, occasionally a character will come along. It's so extraordinary that she transcends all of those or many of those binding forces of the society. And Eleanor Aquitaine is that person. You know, she is a woman who took control of her career, her life, her, you know, destiny, if we want to get really sort of over the top about it, and shaped her fortune and her world, and, you know, managed her way out of a bad marriage to Louis VII of France, who you know, had forged this enormously successful, to begin with, partnership with Henry II of England, who endured, who led a rebellion against Henry II, endured imprisonment at his hands, and then came back and held things together for her two sons, Richard and John. And it is genuinely a phenomenal story that transcends its age in many ways and has at its centre this obvious, you know, we know actually vanishingly little about Eleanor, certainly compared to many of her family. However, the sense that she has left on the sources and on the world in which she existed is that of just an incredibly charismatic and capable politician and woman. And I'm endlessly fascinated by her. And she crops up actually in this new book, Crusaders, because she's such a fantastic character to carry a portion of the story, that being the Second Crusade in particular, when she traveled to the Kingdom of Jerusalem with her then husband, Louis VII, and was accused of all sorts of sordid misdeeds with her uncle in Antioch. And she's just the most brilliant character, and I'd like to include her in every book that I ever write, I think.
We all have that one person in history. I think that we feel so connected. For me, you might be surprised to hear that person I feel most connected to is from the Tudor period, and it's Thomas Seymour. There's just something about him that I feel like I can connect with his story.
Well, yeah, sometimes you get that. And I think you just got to embrace it. You've got to go with it. You know, somebody's experience over the centuries will speak to you. And when it does, to slightly return to one of your earlier questions, it's worth embracing. And often that's how people find their way into history, through, you know, a single story or a single person's experience that they connect with, and then start to kind of unpack other aspects of the past from there.
So moving forward to Magna Carta, we see its legacy even in the United States. What was the main purpose of the Great Charter?
It was a peace treaty. It was a peace treaty between John and the barons that failed. It aimed to compel a king to rule according to the law of the land, which was a very difficult thing to do because it required constraint of the king in a system where the king's ability to act without constraint was in essence essential to the good working of government. So, but its immediate purpose was as a peace treaty, and it enshrined a number of different political positions, some fairly sophisticated, what we now call constitutional principles, and it contained, certainly in its original issue in June of 1215, it contained a mechanism by which the king could theoretically be chastised, constrained, or even replaced if he broke his own laws. However, because it contained that mechanism, which is known generally as the security clause, and it said that 25 barons can make war on the king if he breaks the terms of Magna Carta, this peace treaty led immediately to, and inevitably, to a recommencement of the same civil war, which only ended with John's death and then the subsequent expulsion of Louis of France in 1217. So you've got to see Magna Carta as a stopgap, really. In its political context, you've got to see it as a stopgap in this war between John and the barons, which was itself the culmination of rising tension over the decades before between the English barons and their Angevin or Plantagenet rulers.
So now I want to jump forward a little bit to the 14th and 15th century, which saw the Hundred Years' War. How did the fallout from the Hundred Years' War impact both the Plantagenets and the Tudors in the late 15th to early 16th centuries?
The fallout of the Hundred Years' War. Well, I suppose domestically, it's two things. It's expensive and it's humiliating for the English, because from the high point of Henry V's achievement of, in theory, a dual monarchy of England and France to be realised under his successor, as it turns out to be Henry VI, and the granting to England under treaty of about a third to a half of the territorial landmass of France, you end up with pretty much nothing left bar Calais, incredible financial difficulties at home, a child king who turns out to be the aforementioned Henry VI, who's totally hopeless, and a long-running civil war, which we now know as the Wars of the Roses. So this enormous misadventure overseas for, during the late 14th century phase and early, the first half of the 15th century, gives you more or less the Wars of the Roses. And the Wars of the Roses, as we know, give you the accession in 1485 of Henry VII. So there is a sort of fairly direct narrative that takes you from overstretch in foreign warfare to domestic crisis and civil war to quote-unquote regime change in the form of the Tudors.
So you mentioned Henry VII, the Wars of the Roses. As we all know, there's a lot of controversy around Richard III's reign. So what are your opinions on his effectiveness as a ruler, and how do you view him?
Oh, God, you're just trying to get me into trouble. I almost despair of talking about Richard III because it's impossible to have a sensible conversation.
I agree.
objectively, look, there's very little you can say because Richard ruled for such a short period of time. He appeared to be and probably was a very sort of competent deputy or one of a number of competent deputies to his brother Edward IV. However, the circumstances of his accession within the context of his nephew Edward V's accession were just fatal for everybody involved, ultimately. And it's very hard to assess Richard's domestic legacy because there wasn't really one at all. I mean, look, people always point to some sort of apparently very progressive and forward-thinking domestic legislation on being nice to poor people. But really, I mean, give me a break. Like, there is vanishingly little that you can say at all about any kind of domestic program of Richard III because the entire reign was focused on, A, securing the crown, to my mind, illegitimately, and B, defending it, to everybody's mind, unsuccessfully. So what lies in between? A few months of sort of scrabbling around, really. And I resent, actually, you've even asked me this question, because now as soon as people listen to this, they're going to start just hounding me on the internet once again. And one of the reasons I've run off to the Middle East, as it were, to write about the Crusades, is so I never have to deal with the fruitcakes and kind of wonks who constitute the broad mass of Ricardians. See, look, I mean, even now I'm talking myself into trouble.
You're making it worse.
I'm making my life objectively worse.
So we'll change gears a bit after that last question there. Okay. You were fortunate enough to study under David Starkey. Mm-hmm. Who are some of your favorite historians that we may recognize by name?
Today?
Of all time.
Of all time? Well, like starting with Herodotus. Who are my favorite historians? Oh God, that's like saying, hey, what's your favorite book or your favorite album? Suddenly one's mind goes blank of everything they've ever listened to or read. Listen, David's absolutely fantastic. You know, in terms of people who taught me, obviously I still greatly admire them. So Helen Castor was my first supervisor. She was just totally brilliant and sort of got me into the Middle Ages. Christine Carpenter, who was the generation above, who was a great professor of English medieval history at Cambridge. I was taught by Christopher Clark, taught me modern history, great professor at Cambridge also. So those are my kind of teachers. David, you mentioned David. Of that generation, you know, Simon Sharma, I think some of the work that, you know, his book on the French Revolution was absolutely incredible. You know, he was, you know, brilliant prose stylist and, a, you know, a great historian, great man. Let me look around my shelves. I love Mary Beard, writing, you know, about Roman history today. You know, there's just read John. I mean, I'm reading a lot of Crusade history at the moment. Jonathan Phillips is a fantastic Crusade historian. Obviously, you know, if you want to go into Crusades history, there's, you know, very few people are better than Stephen Runciman, who wrote the great three-volume history of the Crusades. But, you know, Jonathan Riley Smith, when he was alive, supervised me at Cambridge as well. He was fantastic. And then, if, you know, you've got this... We're so fortunate today. There is this incredible group of historians working. And in the UK, at any rate, we all are sort of peers and kind of move together, really, and see one another quite a lot. And you know, so Susie Lipscomb, who I've done a lot of TV work with, is great. Some medievalists coming up at the moment. Sophie Ambler has just published a fantastic book about Simon de Montfort, which I would highly recommend to all of your listeners when that comes out in the US. That's called The Song of Simon de Montfort. God, there's just so many. And you know, it'll end up like an Oscar speech. And then the two people I miss out will complain.
What's one thing, Dan, that you would like the listeners to know about what it's like to be a historian?
It's a lot of time on your own. And it takes a lot of work, I guess. You know, the job is digesting massive, massive, massive amounts of material, sifting, sorting, building story architecture for it, and then presenting it. And about 10 years ago, I went in LA to Freddie Roach's gym. Any of your readers, your listeners, sorry, who like boxing will know Freddie Roach is legendary boxing trainer. Manny Pacquiao is one of his sort of great fighters, but they've trained many, many, many great fighters. And in Freddie Roach's gym, which is above a laundrette in Hollywood, there's just one phrase on the wall, and it says, "It ain't easy." And what is true of boxing, weirdly, is also true of writing history books. It ain't easy. And there's lots of times of despair that, A, you're ever going to get done what you want to get do. You're ever going to do what you want to get done, or B, that you're ever going to make enough money to afford the next meal. I think it's hard. It's hard. It's very rewarding. If you want to make a load of money, move to San Francisco and learn to code. Don't become a historian. But it is, at the same time, massively rewarding.
When you go through those tough periods, who is that person that helps push you along?
Me.
Just you.
Really? Me. Yeah. That's inspiring. I mean, I've got a great family around me and loads of great colleagues who I can go to, but ultimately you're on your own as a writer, and that's how it is. And you've got to, that's a big part of the job, is accepting that you have to have an enormous wellspring of creative inspiration within yourself and resilience to continue working. Because it's a job that you're, particularly if you're writing books, where ain't nobody really invested in the work except for you. And you can complain about it or discuss it with. And I have, you know, I'm very fortunate to have a group of great editors I work with across my various publishing houses who are great to bounce ideas off and will help chip me along. And my agent will also do that. But ultimately it comes down to yourself, your self-belief, your ability to motivate yourself. And if you don't have that, then it just isn't going to work.
You know, it breaks my heart to know that many of my listeners and followers aren't familiar with your writing, that they were only really introduced to you from your series, The Secrets of the Great British Castles, which is on Netflix. But let me tell you, you really did an amazing job on that. But my question, because I, you know, have to cater to those listeners as well, is which of those castles was your favorite to visit?
Oh, man. I really liked Dover Castle, which turned out, although we didn't film it in this order, to be the first episode in the first series, because it just had such a broad range of stories connected with it, right from, I mean, ultimately kind of Iron Age times, although we didn't delve too closely into that in the show, but from kind of Plantagenet era right through to the story of Dunkirk, and even, you know, the nuclear bunkers that were built during the Cold War in the cliffs underneath the castle. And I really like that sense that here's a structure that doesn't just take you from, let's say, the 12th century through to the 17th century, which is generally the case with castles, because after the 17th century, as military technology, they're obsolete, but actually runs you right the way through to 1980s. That was my favorite, I think. But it was making that series was great. You know, it was so much fun, and it has been, you know, perennially successful in a way that I don't think any of us who made it could ever have predicted.
If they were to ask you to do another season, which castle would you love to showcase?
Well, the one we didn't do was Windsor Castle, because it's like the Queen lives there, right? And so she didn't take that kindly to you can't really get into Windsor Castle to do a whole lot of filming. That would be the British based one that I'd like to do more than any other. But I think, you know, if we ever were to do a third season, which doesn't look especially likely, but one lives in hope, I think there's so much more to be done if you go outside the UK. I mean, there are great castles in Ireland, but there are fantastic castles in France, you know, Chateau Gaillard, the Alhambra in Spain, you know, you know, take your pick in Portugal, Italy, Germany, all the way through to, you know, if it's ever properly safe to go back and film into Syria with Cratchit Chevalier and so on. Or of course, you know, why don't we go out to Hearst Castle in the US and see, you know, a modern iteration. I don't know, like, there are so many that I would do, but I think my horizon just sort of have moved in recent years in terms of what I'm writing about and studying outside just British history and to see British history within the context of the history of the West at large. And so I think if I were making another season of it, that's what I would try and bring to it. Of course, that would mean the budget would have to be about three times as big. And that's yet another reason why it probably won't happen.
Well, to finish out this interview, I do have a few more fun kind of get to know you questions. Oh. And I'll try to go through them quickly here because I've held you for a while.
Okay.
So I personally have several nicknames. My maiden name was Brinker. And when I was a kid, I was called Stinker Brinker. As an adult, I've been called Rebel Jackson, which right. obviously says a lot about my personality, I think. What nicknames have you had?
God, I don't know. I mean, none to my face that I can either repeat or recollect. My daughter Ivy calls me Fat Chicken. I don't know why, because I don't consider myself especially portly or cowardly, but maybe she sees something that I don't.
It's a term of endearment. Well, that is too funny. Well, I cannot help but notice that you have several tattoos. How many do you have?
Lost count. It's above two dozen, and I just got one this week, which is inspired by Friedel, the tournament book created in the 15th century, called Maximilian the First, which is like two knights jousting and one sticking a lance to the other one's eye, which is kind of left side rib cage through kind of hip area, which was dazzlingly painful.
That sounds painful.
Yeah. Mm. So I've kind of lost count. You know, once you start, there's really no stopping, and I'm onto my hands now and everywhere. So that, like, I only hope I don't end up like Mike Tyson with it on the face. That's the only.
That's just trouble. Face and neck tattoos. You got to watch out.
It's becoming more acceptable, really, but face, I think, is still, you know, there's a girl called Grace Normal, whose studio I was in this week in Hackney in London, has the whites of her eyes tattooed blue. And I think when you get to that stage, you're like, wow, you're in deep.
If I could give you a time machine, where and when would you go with no limits?
I mean, like, rather than sort of last Wednesday when I did the online shopping and I forgot to add lime cordial to the, I want some now. I would... I've got to go to the place that I write about, right? You know, I think I would probably go to the Tower of London. Go and get myself in trouble again. The Tower of London, sometime in 1483, slash possibly four, and check out what was really going on with those little princes.
There's so many more things that I want to follow up with that, but I don't want to get you into trouble.
Protect me from myself, please.
All right. Is there anything else that you would like us to know about your books?
No, except that I just pour myself into them. And I think it's incumbent on each and every one of your listeners to reward that effort that I've gone to by going out and buying a copy for yourself, a copy for your aunt, and a copy for your children, because I made them for you.
Dan, can I ask? We know that you finished Crusades probably a while ago. What are you working on now?
So I'm finishing up working on another book with Marina Amaral, my great friend and collaborator, she colorizes photo, black and white historical photos. And we did a book last year called The Color of Time, which was amazing. And has, you know, gone to, like, I think it's nearly 20 countries now in translation. And it's just, she's just such a genius, such a, like, brilliant artist. So we're doing another book together for, I believe it's autumn 21. And then I've just agreed to do another big book after that, but I can't tell you because I haven't signed the deal. But it's big. It's big in every sense, and it's really super exciting. And I'm, like, so stoked about it. So we're going to have the run of Crusaders this autumn, October 1st in the US, another Color of Time book next autumn, and then I guess the autumn after that, the biggest book of them all. So it's kind of an exciting couple of years lined up.
Mm. And we eagerly await the announcement of what that new project will be.
Oh, God bless you. I'm not trying to tantalize you on purpose. I just literally can't tell you.
All right. How can listeners find you and buy your books, Dan?
You can find me, I guess, online. You can find me on Twitter at DG Jones, on Facebook, Dan Jones Historian, Instagram, that not very easy to say, D_A_N_Jones. I didn't think that through so well, but try being called Dan Jones and getting a handle that someone else hasn't claimed already. As you said, you can watch Castles on Netflix, or you can go to your Barnes & Noble or any other great bookstore. Go to your local indie bookstore and support that, please. And if they don't have my books in stock, then please make a fuss. Cause a scene. Complain until they stock them. I hope you'll enjoy them.
Dan, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. It was really a lot of fun.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for checking out the Tudors Dynasty podcast.
Read more.
Read more on the blog at TudorsDynasty.com. Follow Tudors Dynasty on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Subscribe to Tudors Dynasty on iTunes. Thanks for listening.
Before I head out for a couple of months, I need to take a quick minute to thank a new patron, Reagan H. Reagan, you and all of the other patrons are the people who make this podcast possible. So thank you so much, you guys, for the last 3 years of the Tudors Dynasty podcast. I promise you when I come back in 2 months, it's going to be even better than it is now. Thank you so much for your support.